We'll be out at 1:30 is our expectation. Okay. We need more. That's all I'm going to say.
We're just going to hand ourselves.
We're recording.
Ready to go?
All
right. Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We're going to start off with a couple of Bar Association bills. Senator Thompson, if you'd like to come forward with Mr. Dunleavy. And while you're coming forward, I will indicate that it's our intention, and I will have to try to hold myself to this too, to start promptly at our appointed time, noon. We have very limited committee time this session, and we're going to have to use all of it. So we're going to encourage members to plan to be here when the gavel comes down at noon so we can take action on the bills as we take them up. And hopefully we'll have ample time to get the discussions in that we want to get in, but we're going to have to keep the ball rolling, as they say, so that we can accomplish the work this committee seeks to accomplish this session. I look forward to working with everyone to do that. So we're going to start, with Senate File 72, Senator Thompson is carrying this bill on behalf of the Real Property Law Section of the State Bar Association. And we have Mr. Dunleavy, you chair of that section?
Negative, Your Honor.
Or just on behalf of them?
Mr. Chair, I'm a co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section.
Perfect. Well, you've appeared many times before this committee. Welcome back, which is almost an annual right, I think, with these kind of important changes. So, Senator Thompson, your bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 72 deals with essentially title work, and it is a technical bill. I appreciate, by the way, you being a co-author on the bill. I don't anticipate any significant objection to the policy objectives that we have. Currently, Minnesota Statute Section 505.03 governs abstract of title requirements or title requirements when it comes to various real estate transactions. And it talks in terms of the kind of title that is required for plat approval. Some local governments have interpreted this statute to absolutely require an abstract of title. Others have been a little bit looser on the standard. So what the purpose of this bill is to attempt to make clear to local governments that they do not have to require an abstract of title, but that rather satisfactory evidence of title may include an abstract, a certificate of title, a title opinion, title commitment, or a title policy. And the bill really is no more complicated than that. I don't know whether you want to do this first or after Mr. Dunleavy speaks. We do have an A1 amendment, which puts the bill into the form that I would like it to be, and that, in fact, accomplishes the things that I just described. Not being a member of the committee, I can't propose that amendment, but if somebody is willing to do that, I'd like to get that put on the bill.
Sure. This will be in the nature of an author's amendment. Senator Newman moves the A1 amendment. Do we have copies of it out? I think we're waiting on copies of the amendment to arrive.
Okay. So shall we have Mr. Dunleavy go?
Oh, yeah, and we can't act until we have a quorum anyway. So why don't we just go on with the description and testimony on the bill, and as soon as we have copies of the amendment and a quorum, we'll take action.
Sounds good, Mr. Chairman. At this point, then, as you know, Mr. Kevin Dunleavy is here, and I would ask that he try to do a more detailed and thorough job of explaining the problem as well as the solution that this bill will give us.
Mr. Chair, what we're trying to accomplish here
is... Go ahead and state your name for the recording.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I'm the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. I'm a real estate attorney, basically. What we're trying to do here is make it so that it's not necessary to buy an abstract in order to plat property. I haven't seen an abstract for about 20 years. All of my title work these days is either on the internet or with title commitments and title policies and title opinions. So abstracts are nearly obsolete, not quite, but they're getting there. They're about $1,500. These other types of title evidence are probably more in the vicinity of $100, $150. So it gives the local governments more flexibility, and the developer doesn't end up spending money that's basically wasted to buy an abstract if they're able to use a title commitment or a title policy or a title opinion. That's all we're trying to accomplish with that, with the first part of the bill. Do you want me to talk about the second part? Okay.
Okay, before you go on, we do have a quorum present now, and in about a minute we'll have copies of the amendment. Which is, so now you can go on, and once we get the copy of the amendment, we'll circle back to that.
Okay, the second subdivision or section of the bill, right now Minnesota has two types of title. There's torrens and there's abstract. And if mom and pop sell the farm or the house to the young couple on a contract for deed, and then the young couple doesn't pay, mom and dad cancel the contract. And with abstract property, that's all they have to do. They just record the cancellation, they're done, they can sell it to somebody else. But with torrens property, they have to go to court and do what's called a petition subsequent, and attorney's fees are like $3,000 to $5,000 for a petition subsequent. What this does is, this is in, a concept that came from the examiners of title. They're the judges that run the torrens system. And they're trying to make torrens more user-friendly. And so they're saying, if the cancellation's been recorded for 5 years, you don't have to go to court now. You don't have to spend that $3,000 to $5,000 to clean up the title after a contract for deed cancellation. You can just write a letter to the examiner of titles, and if the cancellation is okay, then they'll give an order saying that's ineffective. So this is a consumer-friendly bill to make torrens property more user-friendly for the sale of property by contract for deed.
Okay, I think we have copies of the A1 amendment in front of everyone now. And Senator Thompson, the A1 amendment is in the form you'd like it adopted. Is that correct? Do you have a copy of it in front of you as well?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Has everyone had an opportunity to read through it, including our resident real estate attorney, Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, I would like to suggest one change to the A1 amendment, either by an amendment to the amendment or just incorporated. I believe that Senator Thompson is in agreement with the suggestion, and that would be on line 1.4, change the word may to shall.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I consider that to be a friendly amendment. It was discussed before the hearing. I mentioned it to you, and it's also been discussed with Mr. Dunleavy. And just so the remainder of the members of the committee know why this is done, Senator Newman and I both had the same concern, and that is that we don't believe that legislative bodies such as town boards, councils, et cetera, necessarily have the expertise to determine what kinds of documents should be sufficient to convey good title. And so we believe it ought to be limited to the things on this list, that being abstract of title, certificate of title, title opinion, title commitment, or title policy. So by changing the word may to shall, as Senator Newman has suggested, that would mean that these legislative bodies would be limited to the things on this list. And I believe that's prudent both to give guidance to attorneys and to make sure that we don't end up with relatively loose title standards that could end up causing all kinds of problems here in the state of Minnesota. It was discussed with Mr. Dunleavy, and he is comfortable with it. So that's the reason for the change, and I'm unaware of any opposition to that change.
Okay, so Mr. Chair. Senator Hall.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Thompson, you said, if I got it right, that this would make it so that they would know exactly what was needed. Would they ever ask for things beyond this? I guess I'm getting to, should it say, shall only include these subjects? Or is shall good enough for that?
I'm going to ask Senate counsel and if it makes any difference, or if only needs to be added to clarify, or if shall is limited.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I would probably say satisfactory evidence of title means an abstract of title, comma, certificate of title, comma, title opinion, title commitment, or title policy, comma, as determined by the city council, town board, or board of county commissioners.
So, Mr. Chair, my question then is,
Senator Hall,
would they ever be asking, for some reason, they want more when we think this is sufficient? And thus we would be limiting to just this.
Just a question.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a something that we did discuss with Mr. Dunleavy before we came in here today. I would suspect that Mr. Dunleavy has probably got more expertise than any of the members of this committee on this subject. I'd like to hear what he would have to say as to whether or not simply striking the word may and putting in the word shall would be sufficient to accomplish what Senator Thompson has outlined.
Mr. Dunleavy.
My own personal opinion is that changing may to shall probably works, but Senate Council has a lot more experience than I do at legislative drafting, so I defer to her. But as far as the question of other types of title evidence, these are the four best types of title evidence that's available right now. There's two other kinds that we don't think is acceptable by itself, and that is what's called an owner's and encumbrancer's report or an O&E report. And all that does is tells you who got the last deed and what mortgages are out there. So it doesn't give you a full chain of title. And then the other type of title evidence that's available now is electronic. You can go on. Most counties of the state have some type of electronic database that you can go look at on their website, and some of them are commercially available too, but they're not a complete source of title. These types of documents give a complete source of title, whereas the other stuff that's available doesn't at the present time. That might change in the future, and it might be that eventually everything's going to be electronic, but right now it isn't.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
I think that's my point, that some may say, well, I know this is what it says, but it doesn't limit us so that we can go and add more. We would like to see something else. And the question is, if these areas encompass what is needed and you don't need anything else, if a agency decided they wanted something else, they'd just add to the bureaucracy, and this way we'd be limiting it so they couldn't ask if we say shall only. But again, council, I think, would know that.
Well, Ms. Pontius, you had a drafting suggestion.
Mr. Chairman, if you wanted to just change the may, you could change that to must. That would be the most straightforward.
Then, as drafted, would it limit the options for the local legislative body so that they couldn't say, they couldn't allow other forms, the other two forms of evidence of title to be used? Because I think that goes to Senator Hall's point.
That's how I would read it.
So that basically, even though the local legislative body has must make the determination, we're telling them what determination they must make. So in essence, we're removing from the local legislative body the discretion over this, which is probably not a bad idea in terms of effective statewide policy. Is that the intent of the author?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Thompson?
Actually, we are trying to expand what is acceptable. But certainly this would still leave within the discretion of the local legislative body which one or all of these things to use, because it is an or statement. It is must include abstract of title, certificate of title, title opinion, title commitment, or title policy. So they'll still have the ability to make that determination. But the real point is to make certain that an abstract is not required, and it will not be, because they can use any one of these, what is it, five things, I believe. So I still believe that accomplishes my intent, but I want to ask Mr. Dunleavy, since, again, it is people within in his area of practice that have to deal with this.
So they could select from among the options.
Yes.
But they must select at least one of the options so that there's an alternative to an abstract available to prove evidence of
title. Exactly.
It's, Mr. Chair, it's possible that some local governments might decide they still want to use the abstracts even though they're kind of a waste of money. Hopefully that won't happen too often, but it does give them that discretion to require an abstract as opposed to a title commitment or some other title evidence.
But they would still have to provide an alternative to an abstract under this amendment, would they not?
No.
I think the language is drafted says the local government decides which of these five things they're going to require.
Yeah, must include, and then it, Mr. Chairman and members, it says must include, but then it's an or statement. So it could be an abstract of title or a certificate of title or.
I see the abstract is the first item on the list, so there we go.
Senator Latz.
Okay. Senator Sherman.
But it does say, and I don't think this is your intent, and I don't know if it makes any difference to you either, but it is Senator Hall, I think, is saying, this says, because it says must include, it doesn't preclude having them ask for something more than this. It just says, of the things they ask for, it must include one of these four things. But they could also ask for something beyond that. And I think what you're asking is, do we want to restrict it even further and say, include this and only one of these? I think that's what you're asking.
It is.
To stop the counties from asking for abstracts that are not that are expensive but may not add to the knowledge base you need in order to accomplish the goal. I think that's what
Thank
you're
you.
Asking.
Yes, well said.
And so what is the intent of the Bar Association on that point?
Mr. Chairman, I'll. Did you
Senator
address
Thompson,
that to me or to?
Okay. Whoever wants to express the position.
Mr. Chair, my response is that we don't want to micromanage this to a level that we're telling each county what they should do because, or each city or township, because in some parts of the state outside the metro area, abstracts are more common and they may be more comfortable with that and the developer may have it. But the way this will probably work in reality is that the developer will come to the local planner, whether it's the city council, city planner, township, or the county, and they'll make a deal. They'll say, okay, here's what I got. Is this good enough? And right now, when that happens, the local government goes to the statute, and the statute says, I got to have an abstract. So this leaves it so that the developer and the planning department can essentially work it out what kind of title evidence is going.
So it provides more statutory flexibility to the local government if they choose to exercise it.
Yes.
Okay. So.
May I ask one more question? I'm sorry, Senator.
Senator Sherman, I know you like to get bogged down in legal arguments over language.
I'm going to go to school for legislators, law school for legislators.
Yes.
You're in it.
I'm going.
Student this year. You can teach it next year.
Yes, I need it. Because I'm not going to ask you to explain the difference again between the two abstract, and I just am curious as to why 5 years. Is there something that we gain or lose around 5 years? Why is that the correct number when you're talking about allows the use of examiners instead of just after 5 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator
Sherman.
Actually, I like it if you ask me questions like that because I know the answer. But the reason we have 5 years on this is it was a compromise. And in the Bar Association, some attorneys were saying 10 years, some were saying 1 year. And 5 years was a compromise based on business risk that if the people who were living there, if the young couple that mom and dad canceled the contract on, if they've moved out and they've been gone for 5 years, they're probably not going to come back and say that there's something wrong with the cancellation. And so that at that point, it's not necessary to have the judicial action where they get served with an order to show cause and they have a chance to come forward and complain about the cancellation.
So, I think your answer is saying to me that after you've processed this with the interests at the bar, that they thought 5 years would be enough to protect the person who has the contract as well as the property owner adequately, whether it's a couple or if it's a business or anybody, that 5 years is enough to assure most of the bar that, those rights are protected.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dunlap.
Senator Sharon, yes, that's correct. I use the example of the couple selling the house because that's a lot of contracts or deed are used for that type of transaction. They're signed at the kitchen table. They don't have attorneys involved a lot of times. But they are also used, like you suggested, in commercial transactions and other deals.
Yeah. Whereas what the county might ask for isn't reliable. Right.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been looking over the amendment, and I came in a late. Sorry about that.
Don't let it happen again, Senator.
Being a former chair, I know how important that is. Punctuality is important. Perhaps someone at the testifying table could answer a few questions. As members know, I sell real estate. And what has been a practice of the title companies, at least this last year, is when I've gone to a closing, sellers often will have their abstract in their papers. They're willing to give it off to the next owner. And the title officer who will be closing, the closing agent for that particular transaction, simply says, oh, we don't use those anymore. So there could come a point in time if this amendment is passed that an abstract of title might be considered more of an obsolete exercise than anything else. Now, the way I read this amendment, could a city council, town board, or county commissioner board require an abstract of title in the future, or is this an option? And they simply require the whole line, the abstract, the certificate of title, the title opinion, title commitment, or a title policy. Can a political subdivision insist on an abstract 5 years from now?
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, under the wording of the statute, unless the statute is amended or changed, yes. One of the options would be to require an abstract of title, and that would be, I suppose, an option for the local body. We would hope that they would change their policies with the times, and that if abstracts are no longer available or prohibitively expensive, that we've given them these other options, and they would use those options.
Well, Mr. Chair, the problem that maybe it's just me looking at this, but remember that story of how title companies are saying you don't need your abstract, you don't need to pass it on to the new buyer, the new owner? Let's go down 10 years down the road. Nobody knows where the abstract is, and a city political subdivision could now require an abstract of title. Won't that mean that you have to recreate an abstract of title to satisfy the local political subdivision for that particular closing in the future?
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, yes, but currently the way the statute is being interpreted by many subdivisions is that is the only sufficient demonstration of good title. So this is actually creating pathways for subdivisions of government, local governments, and so on to do things more flexibly and get rid of the requirement of the abstract. So we're actually going in the direction that you're proposing. I could ask Mr. Dunleavy, but I don't think it would be practical at this point to eliminate the abstract as a legitimate demonstration of title. So we're actually going in the direction of helping political subdivisions to find other ways to do this other than through use of an abstract. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
In the way I read line 4, and may include an abstract of title.
That's going to be must.
Must include. Okay, so it must include basically one of the four options.
Correct.
Is that how I read this? Okay. That's all I need.
Senator Limmer.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a very quick answer to Senator Limmer's question is that whether or not an abstract is going to be required is going to be contained in the contract between the buyer and the seller. So that language, what Senator Limmer's looking for, is going to be contained in the contractual language that governs the transaction.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
But Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, 10 years from now, a seller may not have a copy of his abstract because some previous title closing said, we don't need those anymore, and it got destroyed or kept by a previous owner three transactions back. So there may not be an abstract to even refer to.
We'll have to have faith in the local subdivisions to provide the flexibility that the statutory change will give them.
Sarah Letts.
Senator Sharon.
Just to add to the confusion, since we're, you know, this is just great. This is just a sign of what's yet to come in the judiciary. But I'm listening to Senator Limmer is saying, you know, what you're talking about is when we're talking about what do we hamstring the local government's decision making, or do we retain a flexibility? That's one half of the equation. What Senator Limmer is causing me to think about, and I think he's thinking about, is the seller of the property having to demonstrate ownership or title correctly and the correct history of that. And so this it's a critical point that you're making because the language here allows a local government the authority to decide, and it can still ask for an abstract. And what Senator Hall and Senator Limmer are raising is the possibility that we really should be saying something more like that any of these four methodologies can meet the obligation. And that's a very different approach. And it does allow then for the situation that you're describing, Senator Limmer, that if the abstract is not available for some reason, that the seller can meet the criteria with another format. And I think that I find that an appealing argument, that I think that's important since they all really do meet the obligations of the law of what the seller is needing to provide in order to document their ownership and their rights to the property, and it allows them to be able to move their transaction forward. And I think that that's maybe a notch more important to me than worrying about being overly prescriptive to local government. So I'm just suggesting, based on those comments from my colleagues, that you consider that, and that instead of just saying it's either or and they get to decide, that you simply say that that the obligation can be met using any of these methodologies.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The distinction that I see in terms of what Senator Hall has brought up and what Senator Limmer has brought up is that the purpose of this bill is to assist local units of government in finalizing a platting process. The purpose of this bill isn't for determining marketable title as between buyers and sellers. It's completely different legal issue in my estimation. And consequently, you know, if someone is entitled to an abstract, as indicated by Senator Limmer, that language is going to be in the purchase agreement, and the seller is going to be required to provide it irrespective of what the loan closer says at the time of closing. Completely different issue. And what
ask
we are
you a question? Can I ask you a quick question before you go on?
Senator
just
Sharon.
Be sure. Let's take that off the table, the buyer-seller issue, and stay on the platting issue. I'm sorry, I'm not a lawyer. Is it possible that the person who wants the replatting would not be able to meet the obligations to get the replatting if they couldn't provide an abstract?
The answer,
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, the answer is no. If they were required to provide an abstract and they didn't have one, then they have to hire an abstractor and have one created. That is an additional expense, as indicated by Mr. Dunleavy. but it would not prevent them from moving forward. You can always recreate a new or obtain a new abstract.
And Senator Latz, if I may,
Senator Sherman.
Could changing the language here then in relationship to platting allow for that platting to occur with an alternative tool and save the person the costs of creating an abstract without losing what is needed to achieve the objective of the plat?
And then we put that list in there. And then,
so Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
I believe, Senator Sherman, in response to your question, is that is what this bill is doing, is it is providing an alternative. There's five alternatives presented in this bill whereby the local unit of government can approve the plat, whereas, as if I understand correctly, right now, there is only one. They have to provide an abstract. So the answer to your question is, I think, is located, is in this bill, where the person who is coming forward with the plat is going to be required to come up with one of these instead of just the abstract.
Mr. Dunleavy, did the section consider the question of whether or not to require that a local subdivision provide at least one option for evidence of title in addition to abstract?
Mr. Chair, the purpose that the local government, the reason the local government wants title work is because they're looking for easements. They're looking to see who's the owner of the property, because that's who has to sign the plat. The easements are supposed to show in the plat. And they also want to know if there's any mortgages out there. Those are the three things that they're looking for. The reason that we don't want to be too specific about it's got to be this or it's got to be that is because a developer oftentimes puts several parcels together before they plat it. Some of it might be torrents, some of it might be abstract. They might have a title policy on this, they might have an abstract on that. And so we're trying to leave it so that the local government and the developer can work it out, and it might be a combination of these things rather than just one in any given deal.
It's not worth it.
Okay. So what's your reaction to the discussion that you're hearing as to whether or not it's advisable to prohibit a local government from requiring only an abstract? I mean, under the proposal, a local government could still theoretically say abstract is the only acceptable form of evidence of title, right?
Mr. Chair, the way it's working now is some local governments will say, that's what the statute says. Give me an abstract or forget about your plat. It's not going to happen.
No, I mean, I understand that they feel they're required to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we open this up and give them the flexibility to say they want some other, they'll allow some other evidence of title. But if there's a local government that still wants to require only an abstract, could they do this under the current?
I think they could.
Under the proposed changes?
Mr. Chair, I think that they could. But generally speaking, local governments want property to be developed because it increases their tax base. The value of the property goes up, especially if it's a subdivision. If it's converted from raw land to 40 houses, that increases the tax base. So there is an incentive for local government to want to see the platting done. And there is also an incentive for the local government not to make it too onerous for the property owner because they might go somewhere else.
So you're saying the incentives are there to allow for flexibility in providing evidence of title. But what if you've got an obstructionist local government that wants to only require abstracts and that's the only place they're going? Would you advise the legislature to prohibit a local government from being able to do that?
No. Mr. Chair, I wouldn't at this point because there are some places in the state where that's the best you've got is an abstract. So I don't think that we can eliminate abstracts at this point and say you can't use them.
All right. I'm going to suggest that we consider the full scope of this discussion some other time as perhaps an option down the road, but we at least ought to make the move that is being suggested in the bill.
Mr. Chair, one question.
Senator Limmer, last question. We've got items to hear today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much on the bill itself, but do local government associations and title companies, have they read this legislation, including this amendment, and are they in favor of this or opposed in any way?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, we have talked to local governments about this, and they would be very upset, I think, if we tried to say they couldn't use abstracts anymore. If we limited their discretion, they'd probably be here testifying against us right now. The title companies, I can't speak for the title companies, but there are title company people on my legislative committee, and my understanding is the title companies are okay with this because they don't use abstracts very much anymore either. They use title commitments and title policies.
Is there anyone else in the audience that's got an interest in this particular bill that would like to testify in connection with it? That partially answers your question, Senator. Senator Hall?
I'd like to move the A1 amendment as amended.
I think Senator Newman was about to do that.
Oh.
I don't want to step on. You guys sort it out there. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A1 amendment and incorporate the change on line 1.4, removing the word may and including the word must.
All right. Does everyone understand the amendment? Is there any further discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Is there any further presentation by witnesses on the bill itself?
I have nothing further, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any further discussion or questions from the committee on the bill itself? And Senator Hall moves that Senate File 72, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right. Our next bill is going to be Senate File 73, Senator Newman. And while he is approaching the witness table with his witnesses, if you go ahead and please come forward as well. I will announce that there will be the Law School for Legislators on January 23, 2015, from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the William Mitchell College of Law. If you go, you will have the opportunity to hear from Chief Justice Gilday, Justice Anderson, Barry Anderson, Justice Tammy Pust, Justice Helen Meyer, Commissioner Mary Liz Holberg, Professor Michael Steenson, and more. And Senator Sharon.
I'll be there. You won't be hearing from me, but I'll be there.
But it'll be very informative. It'll cover a lot of the topics that we anticipate hearing in this committee, including an overview of civil law, data practices, sentencing guidelines, child protection issues, administrative law, statutory construction, in light of the last discussion, very helpful, our Constitution, and oversight of the judges in the judicial branch. So I encourage everyone who is available that day or to make themselves available to attend. Now, Senate File 73, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's nice to know that things have not changed in the Judiciary Committee. We go into the weeds very quickly doing that. Mr. Chairman, members, I am presenting this afternoon the Uniform Deployed Parents Custody and Visitation Act. This is a bill that is being brought forward by the State Bar Association and specifically the Family Law Division and the Military and Veterans Affairs Law Section of the Bar. And I would indicate parenthetically that I've been told that the state of Minnesota is the only state in the nation that does not have a similar bill that helps provide a framework for Minnesota custody law when a military member is deployed. So it really is a quite an important piece of legislation. You will find in looking at the bill that it sets out the procedures and the substantive rules that cover custody situations involving deployed members of the military service. The issues that you may want to be looking for in going through the bill, I would point out the following. This bill encourages agreements as between parents when a deployment occurs. It provides for entry of only a provisional custody order. It allows the court to grant a service member's portion of custodial responsibility to a non-parent who is either a family member or someone who has a substantial and close relationship with the child. It provides for no permanent custody order can be entered while the parent has been deployed, and provides that future deployments cannot be utilized as a sole factor in determining custody. I would also indicate that throughout the bill you will notice that the standard that is utilized for implementing this statute, this bill, is the standard which is in the best interest of the child. Mr. Chairman and members, with that, I will have the testifiers that are here at the table with me provide a brief overview of the bill. Seated immediately, Mr. Chairman, to my left is Lindsay Olson. She is the general counsel with the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. And immediately to my right is Joe Claiborne. She is a private attorney in private practice and is also an officer with the Military and Veterans Affairs section of the State Bar Association. Ms. Claiborne, I believe you were going to testify first. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator.
Mr. Chairman.
And thank you. And I should make this general announcement as well. We're going to ask all of our testifiers to focus in on the key points that you wish to make so that we can be aware of the amount of time or lack of time that we have for committee hearings, and then we'll have time for discussion as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Is it
Chairman.
Ms. Claiborne or Claiborne?
It's Claiborne.
Claiborne, okay. Please proceed.
Senator Newman's correct. There are no protections in the state of Minnesota for service members. I am here as a family law attorney who practices a military family law. Specifically, I've seen pre-deployment custody agreements changed. I've seen service members lose custody of their children. And I've seen family ties with step-siblings and step-parents broken. And members of the military, in my role as a military commander, leave the military because they were afraid of their familial obligations being in danger as a result of their service. This particular bill was worked on specifically with both the family law section and the Military Veterans Affairs section to gain a consensus. It's based off the uniform commissioners that had done a drafting approved through the American Bar Association already. This particular bill will help provide some ground guidance for the courts when determining the best interest of children and maintaining contact and providing derivative parental rights during a deployment. So I'm going to leave you with two examples that I've seen firsthand. I had a client, a father, who was a service member who had custody, full custody of his daughter. He was called for deployment. The mom in this particular case had limited contact with the child as a result of domestic violence with several of her past relationships, had moved from home to home, had had four residences in the last year. When the service member got activated for deployment, the mother came forward and filed a petition with the court for her having sole custody of the child. During this time, this child had been also intimately cared for by the stepmother, who had gone to all the things such as school dances and helped with school teacher conferences, and as a result was denied all contact with the child, including the step-siblings that were part of that family. The court struggled in order to provide some sort of derivative right to the stepmother to allow them to maintain contact. Most recently, I was doing a recruiting and retention event in my role as a unit commander, as a brigade commander. We try to ensure our young soldiers stay as much as we can. We've invested lots of time and money in them. I had a young E4, a specialist, very stellar soldier. There was $25,000 enlistment bonus on the table. By all rights, this kid was probably at what we would call a rising star. And when I asked him, why are you not reenlisting? Why are you not staying with us? It doesn't make sense to me. He finally broke down and said, ma'am, I have four kids. I had custody of them with my spouse, my ex-spouse. I was told by my recruiter when I joined that that shouldn't be an issue. Unfortunately, I got deployed. She got custody, and now I have every other weekend. This bill would allow for to ensure that our service members are not penalized as a result of a military service. It would also allow the courts to truly look at the best interest of the children in determining who should have contact with them during that deployment. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Major Lindsay Olson, who will talk about some of the procedural and substantive portions of the legislation being proposed.
Thank you. Major Olson.
Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, I don't want to delve too deep into specific areas. I believe Senator Newman went over the basic provisions of the bill. I'd rather allow time for the committee to ask specific questions that they have concerns about.
Thank you. Are there any committee questions or discussion? As I understand it, this was reviewed by the Bar Association Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs.
It was, and the Family Law Section. It's a result of a year-long process of work groups between Ms. Olson and myself in getting the consensus of the Family Bar Section, which is not an easy feat.
Is there any, Ms. Quibon, is there anyone that you know of that opposes this bill?
I am not aware
of
anyone.
Any organized groups or any individuals in the field?
I am not aware of anyone at this time who does.
And neither am I, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Dietz.
Thank you, Chair Lass. I just have a quick question. I am extremely supportive of this and agree with you that deployment shouldn't be a factor. If you look at, if I'm reading this, there it continually talked about under law of this state other than this chapter. So like on 318 and 319, an individual who has custodial responsibility for a child under law of this state other than this chapter. That comes up, other than this chapter, comes up a few times. So could you just explain? I want to make sure I'm understanding that correctly.
Mr. Chairman,
Major
Senator.
Olson.
That refers to the general custody statutes of the state of Minnesota in 518. And so that this does not supplant that.
Any other questions or discussion? Anyone else in the room wish to be heard on testify on this matter? All right. Senator Newman, do you have a motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know whether or not this should go to the Senate floor or
straight to the floor, Senator.
I'm sorry?
Straight to the floor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would
anytime
move
I
that
can accommodate that, I try.
Yeah.
I would move that Senate File 73 be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor.
Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. All right, members, we are going to move now to an informational hearing relating to issues that we're going to be hearing about in more depth later this session. And that has to do with DWI law and specifically the operation of the law relating to the ignition interlock devices. There is quite a range. Come on forward, those of you who will be testifying. There is a range of bills that have been introduced that address DWI law generally, different portions of it, and an integral part of the DWI law over the last several years now has been the use of the ignition interlock device in vehicles, and the changes that are being proposed have an impact as well. So I thought it'd be helpful for all of us to be able to consider the ignition interlock program as it currently stands. Some questions may have arisen about the operation of the program itself and also how it interrelates with other aspects of the DWI law. I'm going to welcome Joan Kaczynski and Jody Oscarson from the Department of Public Safety to testify, if there's another person with you, go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman, Jill Freudenwald, I'm the Ignition Interlock Program Administrator in DBS.
Terrific, thank you, welcome to the committee. And how do you spell your last name?
F-R-E-U-D-E-N-W-A-L-D, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So you guys decide how you want to proceed and in what order. And you know, we're going to go until 1:30, and we do have the chair of the DWI task force here and a representative from MAD to testify, and we have also available to answer questions the proprietor of a company that contracts and installs the interlock devices as well. So we want to make sure we have time for some discussion. So if you would go ahead, and we'll interrupt you if we have any questions along the way. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Joan Kopchinski. I'm the Driver Services Director. As stated, this is Jody Oskerson with the Office of Traffic Safety and Jill Freudenwald, the Program Manager or Administrator. Briefly, the ignition interlock device is a unit that Ms. Oskerson is pulling out of the box here, in which we'll go into a little more detail. But it's a device that allows a driver to legally operate a motor vehicle if they blow into the device and their alcohol concentration is 0.02 or less. And the device is particularly important to allow any driver or anyone who has been involved with an alcohol offense, whether it's a single offense or it's a multiple offense, the opportunity to maintain their livelihood, to maintain the ability to go to school, take their children to school, basically carry on their daily activities, but with the assurances that if successfully starting the device, they have not consumed alcohol. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to let Ms. Oskerson talk about the device a bit, and we'll be here for questions as well.
Good afternoon. This is the ignition interlock.
If you go ahead and identify yourself for the record as well, please.
Mr. Chair, Jody Oskerson from the State of Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety. And what I have here is just a demonstration device of one of our interlock devices from one of our companies in the state of Minnesota. So this piece here is the handheld part of the device that the driver would blow into as they're going down the road or to start the device. It has informational messages on it. Right now it's telling me to blow now. So when it beeped that second time, that meant for me to inhale. So I blew and then inhaled, and now it's analyzing my breath to determine if there's alcohol on it. And then after it's done analyzing, it will tell me whether it's okay to start the car or if I failed. And I passed. So now it would let me start the car.
Plus, I'm worried about that.
We're all holding our breath.
All of the devices in the state of Minnesota are required to have a camera in the car. Most of them are up on the upper left-hand corner. Those pictures are taken every time the person starts the car, blows into the device, and then they are transferred from the interlock provider to driver and vehicle services. And if there is a fail on that device, then that takes appropriate action on the driving record. The other part of this program is we also have, our office also has a judicial program where we are funding 5 judicial districts in the state to help with interlock fees. And so probation and the courts are using the ignition interlock also in their districts to monitor offenders. And it's also helping the courts and probation monitor the use and make sure that people are getting to be a valid driver.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier here, are those used in a car, are they limited to the offender, or if somebody else wants to use that car, they do the same thing?
Anyone that uses the vehicle, Mr. Chair, Senator, anyone that uses the vehicle needs to use the device.
Okay.
And when they install the device, the provider, the service provider, is required to show them how to use it, have them practice it. And we always strongly suggest to the offender that they bring anyone that's going to drive the car with them so that they can learn how to use it. Instruction manuals are also provided.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gogan.
What prevents them from driving another car in the family?
Mr. Chair, Senator. Everyone, if someone hasn't been legal in the past, they've chosen to drive. But what we found when we were doing the pilot was most people were very thankful that they had an opportunity to drive legally. They're not looking behind their back waiting for someone to pull them over. You're always going to have someone that tries to circumvent the law. But we do have people, and if you, we included a one-pager, and it shows that we've had over 9,000 people, participants, graduate successfully from the program, and we currently have over 8,000 people on the program. But unfortunately, we always have that small demographic group that chooses to drive illegally sometimes. There are statutes on the book that if they're caught driving without ignition interlock and they have the restriction on their driver's license, they are can be convicted of that, and that can affect their time on the ignition interlock program, and they can be extended for violating that.
And if I can, Mr. Chair, members,
The
ignition interlock is not a new program. In 2007 through 2009, there was a pilot program in Beltrami and Hennepin counties. In 2009 through 2011, there was a statewide pilot program, and then the ignition program that we're currently are working under was effective July 1st of 2011. So there's some history here as far as how the device works, who and you know how it's appropriate for the family use, and it really is a deterrent to those who have in the past chosen to drink and drive to no longer drink and drive, because now they are driving legally if they have the ignition interlock device installed in their car.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodman.
Who pays for the device?
Mr. Chair.
That's good, sounds good.
Member, the individual pays for the device. And we've got some information about the installation charges, if you'd like to hear about that.
Yes, please.
That's also, excuse me, Mr. Chair, that's part of the packet.
Okay, so members, in your packet, there's a sheet that lists one of the pages titled Vendor Fees, and it's got a front and a back. I do have a question. Are there any vendors in Minnesota other than the ones listed here?
Mr. Chair, no. They have to go through a certification process every year, and so right now there's five vendors that are working in the state of Minnesota. And on your vendor sheet, the front is the vendor fees, and on the other side is the indigent fees.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to the fees in a second, but just part of the background here, members, is that there's been nationwide scientific data that indicates that that where the ignition interlock device is mandated in certain circumstances in a state for people who have a history of DWIs or even a first timer with a high test, as it is in Minnesota, that they're more likely to drive with insurance and not drive drunk if they've got the ignition interlock device in their vehicle, which promotes public safety. And the science on this is pretty well established, as I understand it now, from the use across the nation for much longer than Minnesota has had the program. In Minnesota, if you want to get your driving privileges back right away after you've been arrested for DWI and served with the implied consent license revocation notice, if you have a first-time offense where you're a 0.16 alcohol concentration or higher, or if you're a repeat offender, you're mandated to use the ignition interlock device if you want to have your license back before the end of the expiration period of the revocation, which starts at a year in those categories.
So Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodman.
Well, tell me with this vendor fees chart, please. I'm looking at it, and it looks to me like it's close to, well, for the first technology there, consumer safety technology, about $100 a month plus installation charge you about $110 to $120. That's like a right off the bat to get this, it would be like $220, plus all these other little charges in here, security deposits, setup fees, damage protection, check by phone, chargeback fee. What does it actually cost? I mean, it's very confusing to me what it actually would cost a month with all these additional charges on here. It seems to me, let me just say this comment, that you only really would have the opportunity to drive if you had plenty of money to get one of these devices.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Ms. Oskarson.
Typically, it's the average is about, as you can see, the installation rate.
Yes.
Put it on, it's about $100. And then it averages anywhere as from $78 to $125 a month for calibration. The other fees that are here is if someone is failing on a breath test or if they get locked out of the device because they're supposed to come in for calibration either at 30 or 60 days and they don't do that, then they get locked out. Those are the fees. There's also fees if they decide they want to change from one vendor to another fee or to another vendor. So those fees are all additional fees. That's not necessarily, if you have someone that is compliant that doesn't drink, they're not going to have additional fees for early recall and that type of thing. They're going to have the calibration fee and then the removal fee. And then the we do have that indigent program where the fees are set at $40 per month for calibrating if the person qualifies to be at that in that program. And that's $25 to put it on, $40 a month for calibration, $25 to remove. There's a couple other additional fees that were added this past year, like $50 for vehicle transfer and $25 for a lockout fee and then $15 for an emergency override.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodman.
What are the qualifications for indigent drivers?
Senator, Mr. Chair, we base the qualification on 125% of the federal poverty level. So they sign an attestation that they send in to us, and we ask for their adjusted gross income and how many people are in their household.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Somebody's making a lot of money here. Some of these companies are making a lot of money off of these devices, if there's as many as you said there are in the state right now. It's just a little alarming to me that people with low income, maybe not totally indigent, but with still low income, the ones that would need most to get to work, would maybe be disqualified because of the high cost monthly costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Ms. Oskarson.
When this original bill was going through the legislature, there was discussion about setting prices, but that at that time they thought that if the prices were left to the open market that they would fall. Unfortunately, that really hasn't happened. They do vary across the country. Some states have lower fees than these, and it is unfortunately that's what's happened is we have not had those fees. Typically in other states, when a lot of companies have come in, because of the competition, the rates have fallen. We haven't seen that in Minnesota, and I'm not sure why. But that's we do have the indigent program, and the judicial program that is out of the Office of Traffic Safety right now is helping the working poor that you're talking about. If they qualify, we are helping them with starting the first month. We'll pay the grant will pay 90% of their in their calibration fee, and then it goes down from there. So it would be 90, 80, 70 to get them used to it because there's so many fees that are associated with the DWI at the beginning of their time. There's the reinstatement fee of $680. There's probation fees. There's court fees, fines. And that's what our office, when we were working with our DWI courts, was finding is that because of the fees, there's a working poor out there that really are having a hard time paying for this and getting reinstated. And the goal of our office is to try and get legal insured drivers on the road to be safe for everyone.
Members, in your packet there is some information with regard to ignition interlock facts, and it includes the point that about 8.3%, 722 participants of the 8,658 total in the ignition interlock are indigent, or in the indigent program. So about 8% of those participating now have are participating as in the indigent program, getting the reduced fees. I am a bit concerned about, you know, whether or not there's sufficient oversight for who qualifies for the indigent program. A mere attestation, you know, may not be sufficient in terms of being able to verify that those who are in the program actually qualify for it. And I don't know, we're probably going to do some research on this before we have the actual hearing on the matter. But as to whether or not, what the consequences are of submitting a false information to qualify for the indigency program. My understanding right now is that it's not necessarily a crime to submit that false information, although it may be, and that there isn't any real auditing going on to verify that what they are saying is their income level is in fact an income level, not even spot audits or anything like that. And so I'm a little bit concerned from stories that I've heard that there are people who are driving newer model vehicles and that are still claiming to be indigent, or that from all other appearances maybe and the problem is, of course, if they're qualifying for indigent programs, then the other fees that are charged, the full paying customers have to be hired to overcome you know, those costs. The other thing that's not clear to me, and I don't think we need to go too far into it, I agree that the fees are a barrier to participation. I don't know what the underlying costs are of running the business, so it's hard to say how much money any individual business is making unless you know what their costs are compared to their revenue. But I've heard anecdotally in the field that there are a lot of people who feel that it's a real financial burden to participate in the program. And so as we're considering how to make it easier for people to join the program rather than opt to drive illegally and without, perhaps usually without valid insurance as well, just try to get through that revocation period without getting caught, we want them to come into this program because it's a safer for everyone. We need to address that cost barrier as well. So one point on that, to that is, it is the number, the five vendors, is that number limited by any law or rule, or has it just become a matter of practice that there have only been five certified or licensed in the state?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Freudenwald.
The number is not limited by law or rule.
Okay, so theoretically, the department could license additional vendors if you wanted to do so.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there's a lot of manufacturers in the country, so we're probably only looking at about a dozen. We certify the manufacturer according to statute. So, yes, we could bring in other vendors. We probably have, we have had a couple of other ones that have applied for a certification, and we had one that did pull out of the state, and we had another one that did not receive certification. But other than that, there's only been about six that have ever even approached Minnesota.
Okay. And I've heard various stories about, and of course, you know, I'll consider the sources that they come from have an interest in complaining about the fees, but stories that they're told, well, the actual installation service center will decide what they actually charge to install. I've had stories, I heard a story about a $350 installation fee involved, and you know, whether that's, you know, any, it wasn't listed as one of the vendors that you have on your sheet, so it might have been an installation service center that's tacking on an additional charge, and I don't know if that's authorized. I've heard complaints about the reliability of the devices, especially in the cold weather. And about the impact of those devices on the ability of car repair shops to use their scopes, their electronic scopes, to diagnose other problems with the car's engine. So, I mean, there's a number of issues I just kind of pick up along the way, and I don't expect answers to everything today, but I hope maybe you can consider some of these concerns. Ms. Oskarson.
Mr. Chair, another part of this program is our office hired a vendor oversight person to oversee the vendors and to create an oversight program for the state of Minnesota because we have over 180 service providers in the state, and like you, we've heard stories, and so we knew we needed someone that could go out there and make sure that the people knew what they were doing, make sure that they were compliant with the law, and address any issues that customers brought up to the department. And that person has been working since August of 2013 and has done a fantastic job. He will go out and he educates the service providers. If there's an issue, he talks to the manufacturers right away and addresses those concerns. As far as the cold, every one of the devices that are certified in the state of Minnesota have heaters in them so that they can be, that shouldn't be an issue anymore. Back in 2001, we had a small pilot where there was like nine actual people on the device, and it failed all the time in the wintertime. But that has since, those devices have been changed, and they don't have that problem with the cold as much. There's two of our devices that also have removable heads, so the person can actually remove that head that I had and take it in the house at night so that it stays warm so there's not any issues. So some of those, all these different issues have been addressed over the years. Some of these things have come up during our pilot, and that's, you know, that was the great thing about the pilot is the issues that came up we addressed when the law went into effect so that we could make sure that the consumer was getting a good product.
Thank you. What I'd like to do now is to move on in the testimony to give us some more of the overview here and invite David Bernstein, the chair of the Minnesota DWI Task Force, to the witness table. He's also an assistant Minneapolis city attorney. And David, if you could keep your comments down to 5-7 minutes, something like that, then we'll have time for the next testifier as well. Welcome to the table, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
May I just ask for future, I don't have to have the answer now, but for future information for the last testifiers, if they would provide for me the vendor has to be approved by the state of Minnesota, if there's an opportunity there for in the approval process, in the same way we do for health insurance, that we have certain requirements that address some of what we're looking at here. So I'd like to know if you establish an agreement with the vendors so they can be a provider, and that within that contract you can restrict them from being able to add all of these charges onto this service above and beyond what it costs to install and remove. I mean, it's a hugely, just one fee after another added on here. It makes me wonder what the installation and removal fee is going to. So for a future meeting, you know, for example, there's the administrative closing fee and, you know, a security deposit and a monitoring fee. It just goes on and on here. So in the future, I'd just like to know how. What does a contract look like with one of these vendors? Otherwise, I'm going into the business.
Me too.
This looks like a real estate closing list here.
Yeah, it does.
But you won't need an abstract.
That's right. All right, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am David Bernstein, appearing on behalf of the DWI Task Force. I would note that I am also a prosecutor with the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, but I am not representing that office or speaking in that capacity. I am speaking as the chair of the task force. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak. For those of you familiar with the task force, my predecessor, Steve Simon, was the chair of the task force for approximately 32 years before he rode off into the sunset.
Professor Simon, that is.
Yes, that's true.
Representative Simon.
So I am grateful and honored to carry on his efforts and efforts of the task force collectively. The DWI task force is concerned with public safety, and specifically with respect to decreasing drunk driving on the roads. And drunk driving can be broken down into drinking and driving. And that's what the DWI task force is focused on, is that second part, the and driving. There are many ways to try and curb drunk driving, one of which is an alcohol assessment, chemical dependency evaluations, risk assessments, and we're doing a lot of work to improve those assessment tools. But with the ignition interlock device, the task force is focused on the and driving part. I had an opportunity recently to hear from someone who was enrolled in the ignition interlock program, and what she indicated is that it kept her honest. When she went to drive, there were times when she was found to be over the .02 limit and the car did not start. And that was eye-opening to her, and it helped educate her as to perhaps what her limits might be. And she acknowledged that it prevented her from driving on the roads while intoxicated. And that's what the DWI task force is looking to curb, is the drinking and driving. The task force has a number of recommendations that we're going to be advancing this legislative session, aimed at improving public safety, many of which have to do with the ignition interlock device, some do not. But with the ignition interlock program, there are two things that we want to do. One is increase the incentives to get on the ignition interlock program, and two, decrease the barriers to get on the ignition interlock program. The ignition interlock program is so valuable, but with a number of barriers on it, sometimes people are told that it's just easier if you don't do it. And I can relate, in my experience as a prosecutor, there are very few cases that come through the court system where I see the ignition interlock device in place. And so I'd like to see that number increased in the state of Minnesota. I did provide to the panel, to the committee, a map of all of the state's requirements in the ignition interlock program. And there are many states that make it mandatory for all offenders at .08. Minnesota is not one of those states, although we're starting to become the minority in that regard. But Minnesota requires the ignition interlock program at a blood alcohol content of .16 or for second or third time offenders. It's also required for driving after cancellation inimical to public safety. And unfortunately, Minnesota's recidivism rate for DWIs is the highest in the nation. The National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration conducted a study that was released in March of 2014, and it looked at DWI arrests within the period between 2007 and 2011. And during that time, Minnesota had a 41% rate of recidivism with respect to another DWI. By comparison, I looked at a state such as Illinois, which requires ignition interlock at a .08 level. That requirement was introduced in 2009. And in that same period between 2007 and 2011, the recidivism rates in Illinois were at 16%. And I acknowledge that the requirement for ignition interlock was put in place during the middle of this study. But I do think it's telling, and research shows, as the chair indicated, that ignition interlock is successful in reducing recidivism rates. And so a few of the proposals that the task force has recommended to eliminate some of the barriers are first to target an insurance.
I'm sorry, Mr. Bernstein.
Yes.
That Minnesota recidivism rate number, what year did that go through?
The NHTSA study.
Most recent.
Mr. Chair, the study was from 2007 to 2011.
So it did not include the years where the ignition interlock program was statewide and mandatory. Well, we had the pilot program in there for two of those years, is that right?
I believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And then we've had the 3 years since.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. And so, Mr. Chair and the committee, one of the proposals the DWI task force has to eliminate some of the barriers to ignition interlock is to target this insurance certificate requirement. If someone is attempting to get on the ignition interlock program, they are required to present an insurance certificate signed by an authorized representative of the insurance company. and not just an agent, but an authorized representative. This is an additional step that someone needs to take if they want to enroll in the Ignition Interlock program, but they're not otherwise required to produce this insurance certificate. And so the task force is proposing removing this insurance certificate requirement for those that want to enroll in the Ignition Interlock program.
Mr. Bernstein, that's prepaid for a full year, correct?
That's correct. One of the other proposals that the task force has recommended is with respect to the DWI written test. There is a written test which I believe consists of 10 questions that is required with respect to the license reinstatement process associated with Ignition Interlock. The courts have developed an educational system with respect to chemical health assessments, chemical health awareness, and the task force believes that the education provided by the courts, by probation, and by license providers are sufficient and that this DWI written test is not required. And I do believe there is a cost associated with the written test. I don't know exactly what that is, but there was some discussion about the financial barriers to Ignition Interlock. This is one cost that we would hope to remove in order to allow that money to be spent towards the Ignition Interlock program as opposed to this additional barrier. One of the other proposals that the task force has to encourage the use of Ignition Interlock is to relate it to the license plate impoundment. And I provided a one-page handout on the proposed recommendations. This is number one, the first bullet point. The DWI task force is recommending that license plate impoundment occur at the probable cause stage, in other words, at the time of the arrest. We would then move to increase the notice of revocation period from 7 days, where it is currently, to 14 days. And the 14 days would allow a driver to enroll in the Ignition Interlock program and maintain a limited license so that they are allowed to drive legally and bypass the revocation period.
Mr. Bernstein, I'm asking you to give you about one more minute, and we want some time for MAD to testify as well.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, many of the other recommendations are not associated directly with the Ignition Interlock program, so I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee has at this time.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you.
A representative from MAD, Gina Calistro, please come on forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gina Calistro, and I'm a volunteer with MAD Minnesota. I want to thank you for allowing me to be here this afternoon. In the essence of time, I will talk fast but clear. On April 12th, 2009, Easter Sunday, the day that forever changed my life, the day my parents were struck by a drunk driver. When the day of family celebration came to an end, my mother looked at me, hugged me, and said, Gina, this was the best day of my life. Little did I know, 5 minutes later, our lives would be changed forever. My parents were struck head-on by a drunk driver traveling at 60 miles per hour southbound in the northbound lane. My sister and her young children came upon the crash as they were following not far behind. My parents were both critically injured. My mother was airlifted with life-threatening injuries while my father was transported by an ambulance. They never saw each other conscious again. 63 days later, my father, a Vietnam veteran, an officer who served on the Minneapolis Police Department for over 30 years, succumbed to his injuries. My mother survived but faced years of therapy around her injuries, but more painful was the heartbreak of losing my father. The drunk driver who hit my parents was a repeat DWI offender and was supposed to have an ignition interlock installed on his vehicle. He was unharmed physically but must now live forever with the fact that his bad decision to drink and drive took the life of a one-of-a-kind, larger-than-life man who meant the world to many. MAD fully supports the recommendations from the DWI task force, but we firmly believe more can be done to stop drunk driving. In Minnesota, much progress has been made to stop drunk driving. In 1982, 267 people were killed in crashes caused by a drunk driver. In 2013, 95 people were killed. These are 100% preventable crashes. Sadly, 95 is still too many people who continue to die each year. Also, 2,300 Minnesotans were injured in 2013. MAD calls on Minnesota lawmakers to reform our DWI law by making sure that more convicted drunk drivers receive an ignition interlock device following a DWI. Minnesota's outdated approach of hoping for the best with license revocation alone is not getting the job done. Did you know that 50 to 75% of convicted drunk drivers will continue to drive on a revoked license? This means that license revocation is no longer an effective DWI countermeasure, as the offender will continue to drive even on a revoked license. In November of 2006, as part of the MADS campaign to eliminate drunk driving, we started advocating for ignition interlocks for all convicted drunk drivers. Prior to launching the campaign, only one state, New Mexico, had such a law. As David Bernstein mentioned earlier, today 24 states, plus a pilot program in California, have laws requiring or highly incentivizing interlock usage by all first-time convicted drunk drivers. The U.S. Department of Transportation, the National Transportation Safety Board, the Governor's Highway Safety Association, and AAA all recommend that states require ignition interlocks for all convicted drunk drivers. Now even the alcohol industry has joined the fight. Last year, the Foundation for Advancing Alcohol Responsibility, which is funded by liquor companies, endorsed ignition interlocks for all convicted drunk drivers. Driving with an ignition interlock ensures the offender is driving sober and provides a clear and proven public safety benefit. Studies show, as mentioned earlier, that interlocks reduce repeat offenses by 67% compared to offenders who only had their license revoked with no interlock order. In Minnesota, ignition interlocks, as mentioned earlier, are required for all repeat and first-time offenders with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.16 or greater. First-time offenders with the blood alcohol concentration of 0.08 to 0.15 can get on interlock during their license revocation period, but 80% of all first-time offenders do not, as they can opt for the 30-day license revocation instead. MAD urges this committee and legislature to help put an end to DWI in Minnesota. Let's stop first-time offenders from becoming repeat offenders who may curiously take the life of or injure another Minnesota resident. We can do that by passing legislation already passed by 24 other states, which will assure the use of ignition interlocks for all DWI offenders during their license revocation period. Enclosed in your handouts is also a written testimony that I provided to the committee. Mr. Chairman and committee members, MAD is open and will look at all options available to take steps towards reaching these goals. We have a committee and a coalition that has been meeting and is actually meeting tonight on this topic. I look forward later on in this session for the opportunity to speak in front of you all again. Thank you again for allowing me to be here.
Thank you, Ms. Colistro. And let me say on behalf of the committee that we're sorry for your loss. You've done a lot of good work, and Matt has done a lot of good work around this area. I would also note that there's some discussion in terms of incentivizing the use of ignition interlock around linking ignition interlock use to a return of vehicles that are proposed for forfeiture as well. So for those cases where forfeiture is a part of the process, the idea would be that someone could get their vehicle back and save it from forfeiture, if you will, if they agree to install the ignition interlock device into that vehicle. Otherwise, often what happens is they give up the vehicle, they go spend $500 on a junker, and they drive anyway, but without the ignition interlock in place, which does not promote public safety. So that'll be at least one other proposal that'll be for the committee for consideration. Does anyone have any questions or comments for Ms. Colistro?
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for your testimony. We are at 1:30. We will have more hearings on this topic, so those who wish to participate in the discussion on the record will have other opportunities to do so as we consider specific legislation. So with that, reminder to members that we are going to make every effort to start committees at noon, just because we have such limited time during the session to have our hearings. So I encourage you all to please try to be here as promptly as you can. With that note, we are adjourned.
Kathy, did you want to talk to me about my...